Shop of Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave. My good mic is broke, Rupert. And with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey! Oh, I'm sure you sound fine, Dave. We are, well, I don't know, halfway through at this point, our idea for a miniseries of exploring the modern JavaScript landscape side of front-end development in a way. We've talked to lots of great people that we really consider leaders of that movement and the kind of the world of JavaScript, really. And this week is no exception. We have Rich Harris on. Hey, Rich, how are you? Fantastic. So, Rich is, you know, one of the big projects you work on is called Svelte. And I've confirmed with Rich that I pronounced it correctly, too. It's not Svelte or Svelte or any kind of weird anything. Like, the real world. It means light and lean and trim, right?
That's it. It means listen, slender, graceful, all the things that you want out of a JavaScript framework.
Fantastic. So what can you tell us, I don't know, who you are, where you are, what you do, and then I'd love to talk about Svelte a bunch, because you're on the heels of a 3.0 release, but maybe a little bit about you first.
Sure. I'm a graphics editor at the New York Times. My background is in journalism, and I came into JavaScript as a way of doing more interactive and data-driven journalism. What I do here at the Times is I make a lot of interactive graphics and charts, and I build internal reporting tools, and I do all that in the context of the investigative team here at the Times, working on stories primarily around technology and algorithms and topics like that.
Okay, so I don't know, an article's coming out, you know that because you're in the newsroom and it needs some data viz amazingness to it. You're the guy sometimes, you're on a team that does that type of work?
I'm part of a team. There's a group within the investigative unit comprised of me, Michael Keller, who's a reporter who has a deep background in data visualization and things like that. My colleague, Jen Valentino DeVries, who's one of the best reporters I've ever met, and my editor, Gabriel Dance. And the four of us, we work together on stories, you know, trying to use our overlapping skills to bring to bear on some of these stories, trying to make them, you know, because a lot of these stories, they're kind of abstract, a little difficult to understand when we're talking about privacy issues, stuff like that. And so in combination, the thinking is that we can do slightly different forms of reporting and make some of those issues slightly more vivid to a lay audience.
Right. It's not, I mean, a paragraph is one way to explain something, but chart is another, and I'm sure there's many other interesting ways to kind of get a point across, right? And the Times is really good at that, right? I'm sure it must be a fun place to work because of that, the commitment to that.
It absolutely has a strong commitment. It's one of the newsrooms that made a big investment in doing digital journalism back when a lot of other news organizations were still sort of figuring out this whole internet thing. And so it's built this really deep bench of graphics editors, people who have backgrounds in journalism, but also bring skills from areas like cartography, data visualization, virtual reality now, augmented reality, all of these different fields combined into a graphics department that can build some of the things that you're talking about.
So I always think so much of like newsrooms plus data viz equals D3.
Yeah, well, D3 very largely came out of the New York Times graphics department. It was created by Mike Bostock, originally an academic research project, but it was at the Times that it became the sort of de facto toolkit for building data visualization on the web.
Is it still, or do you, I mean, in, what do you do? Do you reach for it sometimes or reach for other things? It's kind of, are you agnostic in your tooling?
I have a slightly more nuanced relationship with D3. D3 is still very much the de facto package that people reach for when they're building data visualizations. But back when D3 came out, it was, you know, it was a very different time in web development. And D3 was this sort of all-encompassing thing that did all of the complicated stuff around generating paths for charts with the correct type of smoothing, or projecting geo data with this suite of different projections. But then it would also be responsible for the DOM manipulation that takes place at the end of that process. And nowadays, the landscape has shifted a little bit. You tend to have frameworks that do the DOM manipulation for you. And so where D3 fits in for me is as this sort of grab bag of tools that I can use to do all of the really painful mathematical academic stuff that is just way too complicated for a simple-brained man like me to do myself. But then it doesn't do the DOM manipulation. I take the output of D3 and I hand it to Svelte, and Svelte is responsible for actually displaying the data onto the screen.
Yeah, that seems... So D3 has some basic DOM stuff in there. You just don't use any of that. You just like, no, you do the thing where you draw the arc. But once you're done with that, I'll take it and do my virtual DOMing or whatever I'm going to do with it.
Exactly. And, you know, we've seen people do that with other frameworks too. There's a lot of articles and talks and presentations out there showing how you can use D3 with React, for example. An advantage of keeping that separation is that you can do things like server-side rendering with D3, which D3 as a DOM manipulation framework obviously doesn't let you do the same way, because you need a DOM. And if you're just using it as a path generator, for example, then you can generate SVGs on the server side. And if they don't even have any interactivity, then you don't need to ship that JavaScript to the client. And so for me, that is the sweet spot. That's the best of both worlds.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. That's pretty cool. That by removing it from the DOM, you can still... You still got to render it to... I don't know. I mean, it's above my head, so I better not drill into it too far. But you've mentioned React and Svelte. Now, we all know what React is, but maybe less people know what Svelte is. And it's kind of
that
your...
That is definitely true.
It's your... brainchild, I think. I don't know. Why don't you tell us about it, and, you know, without me making any assumptions, what the heck is Svelte?
All right, let me try and do this. So at a very high level, Svelte is a way of building web applications. And the idea is it will build web applications that are smaller and faster than applications built with the frameworks that you're used to. The way that it's able to do that is by taking a very different approach to the process of building an app. Instead of being this ball of JavaScript that interprets your code in the browser, in other words, you know, you give it a virtual DOM and then it kind of figures out how to translate that into something that appears on the screen. What Svelte does is it takes your components and compiles them into vanilla JavaScript at build time. So all of the heavy lifting that would normally be done in the browser is done as part of your build step. And what that means is the JavaScript that you need to serve to the browser is much smaller, and it's typically much faster.
Interesting. So there's a heavy build step to this, which there isn't maybe in other frameworks, and which is maybe spiritually connected to like server-side rendering in a way, you know, when frameworks find out that like, gosh, if we do a bunch of work ahead of time and ship that in a lower level language, there's performance benefits to it. You're saying, you know, you write in this, I don't know, it's not a language to itself, right? But it does compile down into something else.
It compiles from, I mean, you can say that it is a language. We can sort of get into the nuance around that. But that whole idea of trying to shift work out of the browser, whether it's in the form of server-side rendering or something else, that's exactly what Svelte is all about. Because a lot of frameworks, the way that they will sell themselves to you is, we're going to make all of this simpler. We're going to make your code simpler. But the reality is the work still has to happen somewhere. Either the work and the complexity sits in your code base or in your head, or it sits in an external library or framework, or it can sit in your build process. And one of those three options is better for users, because it results in bug-free applications, but it also doesn't mean that you're serving a lot of JavaScript that has to do a lot of work when users are trying to use your application.
Is that built out of your experience, like with the New York Times? I mean, I imagine you probably have numbers on like how many seconds a user is going to wait for a page to load, right?
Cell actually started before the New York Times. It was something that began at the Guardian US, which is where I was before I came to the Times. But it's born out of a similar set of frustrations that I had with the existing tools. It's actually a successor of a sort to an earlier project that I did called Reactive, which was, it was part of the sort of 2012, 2013 era of frameworks. And it got used in a few places, like it's been used inside Apple and Amazon and a major Wall Street bank and places like that. But it never sort of cracked mainstream awareness, but it was very heavily used by us at The Guardian. Over time, I sort of realized that I was part of the problem that we were seeing with JavaScript bloat. Because even though Reactive was kind of this pretty easy to pick up and use framework, and it was pretty performant because of how it was implemented, it was getting a little on the chunky side. And so I kind of took a step back and started trying to imagine ways that we could do the same things that we were doing already with a similar kind of developer experience, but without shipping unnecessary JavaScript to the user. And the compiler approach is the obvious way to deal with that problem.
So when you're making think the mental model is still components, yeah?
Very much so, yeah.
Very much so. So you make a component, component.html and component.javascript, right? And so it is kind of a language to itself. It looks like, as we look at this a little bit, there's unusual things in the HTML. Like the HTML isn't valid or whatever by itself, right? Because there's weird stuff like curly brackets around li elements that form loops and stuff. So it's HTML, but it's like your version of HTML that's intended to be compiled out. And then it by itself doesn't do anything either. You also need component.js to, I don't know, feed it the data that it needs, right?
Not quite. The second part, not quite. A component is a completely self-contained thing. It does start out as HTML. Valid HTML is also valid svelte. The thinking there is that web apps are built out of HTML. HTML inherently can already contain style tags and script tags. So if you're trying to co-locate styles, markup, and behavior, it makes much more sense to do it in the context of an HTML environment than to try and force HTML and CSS into JavaScript. That might be a slightly controversial opinion, but it is a correct one.
I mean, it makes sense. We just had somebody from like the web component land and talking about HTML modules, which is like importing. There's a new proposal to import HTML into JavaScript, but it's technically not something you can do right now, right?
Right. With that starting point, we add the missing bits in HTML that allow it to be a data-driven language. And then the style and the script in combination with that form a self-contained component that you can then import into a JavaScript module and use as a standalone thing. It's just an instance of it is a JavaScript class at that point.
That the compiled output is a class?
The compiled output is a JavaScript class, yes. And so you would do import widget from .widget.svelte and then const app equals new widget, and then you give it a DOM element to render to, and that's your application. And at that point, it's sort of self-contained. It's got its own lifecycle. It's got its own state management. And at that point, you can interact with it from the outside, but you don't necessarily need to. And you don't need an additional library to render that. It's all baked into the component itself.
Yeah, okay. So what you load on the page, there is no like svelte.js on the client because it's a class by that point, and It does. You don't need anything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. You don't ship any lib. It's a compiled lib.
There's this internal library which contains some helpers for constructing DOM elements and stuff in a way that's more minifiable than doing document.createElement all over the place. But those implementation details are basically hidden from you as the component author.
And then, but it is all still JavaScript in a way, but you kind of alluded to it being server-side rendering friendly, though, in a way, or it can optionally can be?
What I've described so far is the client-side version of a Svelte component. When you compile your component, it turns it into this JavaScript class that I described, and then you can use that in the context of a client-side app. But you can also generate a server-side rendering friendly version of that component, which is completely different because it's trying to accomplish a very different job. Instead of creating a tree which has this long life, you're just generating a string of HTML. And so those are two very different things. And so when you compile it with the, we say generate SSR mm-hmm. option, then what you have is a JavaScript object with a render method, and you feed it some data and it will just return an HTML string. And the way that it's compiled, it's able to do that server-side rendering blindingly fast, so much faster than you could possibly do by serializing a tree that was supposed to, that came out of a library that was supposed to work in Node or in browser.
Do you find yourself using that a lot? The end result of maybe something you would do at the times isn't particularly interactive. It's just...
Your AWS costs are going to be lower, essentially, as a result of doing this. We, because of some of the intricacies of the project template that we use for graphics at the times, which really aren't worth going into, I haven't got around to setting up server-side rendering for Svelte components for graphics that we do here at the moment. But there is a companion framework to Svelte called Sapper, which is in the same way that React has Next and Gatsby, Svelte has Sapper, which is this app-level framework that does your server-side rendering, serves some static HTML to the client, and then the client kind of seamlessly hydrates that with a client-side version of the same application. And so you get the benefit of the extremely fast initial load with all of the progressive enhancement built in. But then for subsequent navigations, you get this app-like client-side immediate navigation.
Don't they call it hydration or whatever, right? You get the server-side rendering, and it grows up to be a JavaScript app if it can. That's great. So cool. So you pushed a really philosophically intentionally pushed as much as you can to the build step. Like that's the guiding principle here almost.
That is the guiding. Well, I mean, we need to write down our guiding principles. That is one. Yeah. It's that complexity cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be transmuted from one form into another. And to the greatest extent possible, we want to push that complexity into your build step so that it exists in one place and doesn't burden all of your users.
Yeah, it's nice that that's step one, or at least it's in the guiding principles somewhere, rather than let's make this great DOM library and then figure out a way to push it into a build step if we can as a secondary afterthought kind of thing or something to be left to third parties.
Yeah, although I think that idea has caught on a lot more. And like it was pretty novel, I think, back in 2017, was it? At the end of 2017 when we did the first version of Svelte. Or maybe it was 2016, crikey.
Still pretty new.
It is still pretty new. And these things have a pretty long runway before they sort of break into mainstream awareness, I found. So it's still very much a minnow in the world of JavaScript frameworks. But even still, I think the idea of trying to do as much work ahead of time as you possibly can is something that is kind of standard nowadays in framework design. Angular has a pretty good concept of ahead of time compilation They're building this new rendering engine called Ivy, which is, dare I say, slightly sveltish. Glimmer from the Ember team compiles handlebars templates to a very efficient bytecode format, which is another take on a similar idea. That's very interesting. And there's a couple of other frameworks, like Marco from eBay is doing some of this stuff. And the next version of Vue is going to be doing some slightly more sophisticated stuff at build time, if I've understood their roadmap correctly. So Svelte is definitely not the only framework doing this at the moment, although it's still possibly the purest expression of the idea, since it is compiling to self-contained vanilla JavaScript.
This episode is sponsored by Netlify.com. Netlify is static web hosting without limits. You can start with a drop-dead simple deployment workflow and then go further with dynamic tools you can manage right in your dashboard. They've got everything you need to deploy your project, because you shouldn't have to be an architect expert to build and deploy a feature-rich site. When you're ready to push your site live, you can deploy your site to an ultra-redundant global application delivery network that's purpose-built for serving pages and assets quickly and consistently. You can automate deployment using Netlify's built-in continuous deployment that automatically runs your build commands and deploys a result whenever you push to your Git repository. If you want to add a custom domain, you can buy a custom domain through Netlify or add a domain you already own. Manage DNS zones and records using Netlify's DNS hosting. And of course, HTTPS is automatic. Your site will automatically be secured with a free TLS certificate from Let's Encrypt. No clicks necessary. And anytime you want to preview your changes, you can see what they'll look like in production using Deploy Previews. Get a unique permanent URL whenever you submit a pull request. It's posted as a commit status for easy collaboration. You can deploy AWS Lambda functions without configuring API gateways, coordinating deployments, or setting up an AWS account. Your functions are version controlled, built, and deployed along with the rest of your Netlify site. And the Netlify API gateway automatically handles service discovery. Plus, your functions benefit from the power of deploy previews and rollbacks. You can also manage signups, logins, password recovery, and more, all without rolling your own authentication service. Register and authenticate visitors to your site so you can gate content, enable CMS functionality, make authenticated calls to outside services, and more. You can securely integrate with any service that understands JSON web tokens. And in the past, forms on static sites were always a pain, but you can manage forms and submissions without any server-side code or JavaScript on Netlify. Just code an HTML form into any page on your site, add a Netlify attribute to the form tag, and you'll receive submissions in your Netlify dashboard. HTML files are parsed directly at deploy time, so there's no need for you to make an API call or include extra JavaScript on your site. And of course, you can bring all your favorite tools to Netlify, whether you're creating your own customizations, extending your workflow with open source projects, or integrating best-in-class microservices. Netlify's highly extensible APIs lets you add as little or as much tooling as you need. Netlify's got pricing for every project, so visit netlify.com and deploy your site to global infrastructure in seconds. Our thanks to Netlify for sponsoring this episode.
This is actually like educational for me, because I throw another frameworks under the bus, but you know, I sort of like, well, I wrote a React thing, a component, and then I ran it through Babel Webpack and did all that work, and I think in my brain I'm like, yeah, I did it, I compiled it, you see. But I think the level which you're talking about compiling and the level at which my little Webpack script worked are kind of different, right? Like, you're kind of saying, like, we don't just, like, maybe my React app is still trying to negotiate JSX on the fly. Is that right? The templating, but yours kind of bakes out all the JavaScript to build the template kind of.
Well, your component is useless unless there's React and React DOM loaded on the page, whereas the Svelte component needs nothing.
That's it. The JSX to JavaScript transformation is reversible. Right? People talk about JSX as syntactic sugar, and that's all it is. It turns your angle bracket div into React.create element div. If you wanted to, you could turn it back into the angle bracket form. And so the transformation that's happening there is actually very slight. There is a project by the creator of Webpack, Tobias Coppers, called RawRect, which is kind of an attempt to do with JSX what Svelte does with its components. And it's definitely one to watch. But overall, you know, I think React is the framework that is going to have the hardest time reacting reacting. I didn't mean to do that. Responding to this shift in the framework ecosystem.
Just because, like Chris is saying, to render a React app, you need all of React and React DOM on the page. But your goal is to kind of compile away the framework, right?
Exactly. And if you start from that point, then you will design the framework in such a way that it can be straightforwardly compiled. So style components, I don't want to give the impression that this is sort of constraining what you can do as a component author, but the template syntax of a Svelte component is designed with compilation in mind, whereas JSX, because it is just JavaScript, as they like to remind us, it's very, very difficult to compile that in a completely optimal way.
Right, because at some point, like, you're writing HTML. I mean, an HTML parser is a hard thing to write. It has to kind of like switch modes, right? It has to, okay, now I do JavaScript here and end it here. Yeah.
The fundamental problem is that inside the curly brackets in a piece of JSX, you could have literally any JavaScript expression whatsoever. And it's extraordinarily difficult for a compiler to look at that and say, oh, we know what the range of possibilities are at this moment. So instead, you're sort of forced to have a virtual DOM, and you're forced to have a virtual DOM reconciliation mechanism. And that's where a lot of the cost lies.
So how does, you said Svelte ships with like a very minimal sort of helper library. What's inside of that? I see some like component methods in your docs, you know, like component get, component set, component on. Component
you're looking at the V2 docs.
Oh, really? I'm way too ahead. Oh, yeah. Is V3 different then?
V3 is it's kind of a ground-up rethink of the experience of authoring a web application. It's very different to V2 in a sort of regrettable Angular 1 to Angular 2 type break. So we're actually recommending that people don't start new applications with Svelte V2 at the moment, because in hopefully a week or two, depending on how much free time I can carve out, it's going to change. V3 has a different API. But to answer the earlier question quickly, it's actually not that minimal, the internal library. What it is it's tree shapeable, and the component will only import the little bits of code that it needs to do its job. So you can have a component that has that does very little work, and it will only import the very tiny helpers that it needs for that. But if you have a component that needs to do, for example, rich transitions between states, then it might need to import some more stuff. And so the framework is very featureful. It has a lot of stuff, but you don't pay for those features. You sort of decouple the feature set from the bundle size in a way that has historically been quite difficult for frameworks to do.
That's pretty interesting.
So it seems like next level. And you've like worked on compilers before, or I know you've worked like with Rollup and things like that. That's more like a packer, I suppose. But are you just kind of understand how this all works and this translates, and is that kind of what you're leveraging?
I sort of stumble around in the dark until things work. Is my development process. You're right that I've kind of dabbled in the space before. I created a module bundler called Rollup, which essentially what it does is it concatenates JavaScript modules. But in order to do that, it needs to understand the contents of those modules to quite a deep level. And so I've spent a lot of time with tools like Acorn, turning JavaScript into abstract syntax trees and then traversing over those trees and doing various forms of static analysis. I also wrote an ES6 to ES5 compiler a while back called Buble, which is a sort of cheeky take on Babel, just because I didn't like the way that Babel sort of forced me to do things. So this isn't entirely new territory for me. I would say that the experience of working on those two projects gave me the the sort of baseline of knowledge and the confidence that something like Svelte would be possible.
Wow. So if somebody was like making, you know, in those blog posts where they're like, let's compare the frameworks, React is 30 kilobytes and Svelte is 150, you know, they like measure the bundle size or whatever, that's like, for you, that's like completely inaccurate, because like this your framework tries to compile away from existence, right?
It is kind of a different question, but I would say that it's a meaningless comparison to draw in the first place. You can't compare the size of React with the size of Ember, for example, because Ember is doing a ton of stuff that React is not doing. The same is true for, you know, React and Preact. They look similar, but these things have kind of overlapping goals and responsibilities, but it's always going to be an apples to oranges comparison. What you really need to do is look at the size of an application that uses these things. And that's difficult because you're not going to have many situations where you have the exact same application that's been built with different frameworks. So it is a little bit difficult to compare and contrast these things. I think a lot of it needs to be based on, you know, understanding what they're trying to do and making a qualitative judgment about which framework is right for your needs. There is one attempt to compare these things side by side called the Real World Project. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I mean, I've heard of it, I would say, but the, like, is it kind of like the next level of the to-do app sort of thing?
That's the intention, yeah. It's supposed to be the successor to To-Do MVC, which doesn't really give you a very good idea of what using these frameworks is like day to day. It's a basic medium clone, and it's been implemented in lots of different frameworks like React, obviously, React with Redux, React with MobX, Elm, Vue.
That sounds really interesting, because that's what I wanted to ask you about. It's like, what can we approach this for better or worse, from a developer ergonomic standpoint? Like, let's say in your app, I want to render a slash movies page, and I need slash movies slash, you know, the Avengers or whatever. So I need a little routing, right? Does Svelte even go there at all? Or are you saying, well, we compile down to HTML. So if you want routing, you have movies.html, then you put a folder called movie, and inside of movie, it renders Avengers.html, and there's your routing, you know? Or is there like JavaScript? Do you like have a routing situation?
Svelte itself is completely agnostic as to what kind of routing method you prefer. So I can't call it routing. I'm British. It's routing, and that's that.
Oh, sorry.
if you're looking for an official Svelte router, then it is SAPPA, and SAPPA has a similar approach to Next and Nuxt in that. Exactly as you say, you have a folder structure that contains these components, and as part of the build step, SAPPA will look at the contents of your folder. It will understand the shape of your application and the different routes that the user could reach, and it will build a root manifest based on those. And then at runtime, it will pick the right component based on the current route. It will dynamically import it so that you get code splitting and all of that stuff for free, and then it will render the right page. So that is a, we do
so
have,
it's like an add-on, you know, that's as close as you get to an official thing, but otherwise do it
exactly, yeah.
And then what, so, but you have, you clearly have some state management that looks like it's pretty covered pretty well. You have like a state or a set kind of API, and it takes an object.
Well, this is one of the things that's really different about V3. In fact, this is kind of the motivation for the big
because everybody needs state. You know, if we're going to make these components, that's another thing we agree on, is we all need state, right?
Everybody needs state, and Svelte has a slightly different take on this question to other frameworks, and I'm going to struggle to describe this in the context of a podcast, because I really need to show you some code. But basically, what we've done, and tell me if this is a gibberish way of describing it, is we've taken state management and reactivity out of the component API, and we've moved it into the language itself. Inside a component, you're going to have some state. You just declare them as variables. So, you know, you're building a counter component. You have let count equals zero. And then you'll have an event handler that is maybe triggered when someone clicks a button that increments that variable. Whereas in Svelte 2, you would call a method on the component that changed that state. Whereas in Vue, you would have this dot count plus equals one. Whereas in React with hooks, you would have set count, count plus one. In Svelte 3, you just do count plus equals one. You'd literally just assign to the variable, and the compiler instruments that with a call that tells Svelte that a state change has taken place, and it tells it which piece of state has changed. And so it tracks which changes have occurred, and through that it knows exactly which parts of the DOM it needs to re-render.
So any variable that you declare in a component is kind of like local state to that. It's like localized to that.
Yes. I mean, some of those variables aren't used in the template, so they don't get that reactive treatment applied. It's smart about what it does that to. But basically, the idea is that, you know, historically, one of the big problems that frameworks are trying to solve is how do we tell the computer that this state has changed so that it knows that it needs to update the view? And, you know, Vue kind of figured out years ago that we have a really good way of telling the computer that some state has changed. It's called an assignment. You just do, you know, this dot whatever equals new thing. The difference with Vue is that it has to have this class instance, and it has to have accessors, or in Vue version 3, proxies, which capture that assignment. But because we're all compile time, we can just reassign free variables and it has the same effect. And the result is this wonderfully boilerplate free, very expressive way of writing things. And when you compare a component written in, say, React with hooks versus the same component written in Svelte, the Svelte component is always drastically smaller. The ratio of code that expresses the programmer's intent to code that only exists for the benefit of the framework is way higher.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Can I workshop some names for this? Hookless. call this hookless state.
We call it reactive assignments internally. That was the name of the RFC that began all this. Reactive assignments is sort of a catch-all for the way that Svelte thinks about reactivity and reactive programming.
It's cool. So it's reactive out of the box. I didn't have to set anything else up. It just, your compiler kind of is intelligent enough to understand, I want this to update, or I've included it in the view. So if it updates at any point, just re-render the view.
That's exactly. And it'll do all of the kind of the batching and the scheduling and the stuff.
So the way state is used is like, I mean, there's millions of ways, but let's say there's a tabs component and it's active tab 2. So the second tab has a class of is active on it or whatever. It will do all that stuff, right? You've changed an integer to 2, but then something reevaluates. Well, if that happens to be 2, then I need to change this active string name or whatever.
Yeah, it takes all that stuff off the list of things that you as the component author need to worry about.
Okay. And I do think of state generally in two ways, although it maybe Svelte just changes the way you're supposed to think about these things. One of them is, okay, that's a tabs component, so which tab is active is a kind of piece of local state. But maybe the tabs, like there's a fifth tab if you happen to be logged in, and that logged in state happens at a more, like a different level. Like this component just assumes that it knows about the logged in state, but it has no responsibility for setting it to it. But it does need to react to it. Do you have to think about those things differently? Like global
there's
and
local
state? There's
two ways that you can have state that exists between components. One way is, as in any other Vue framework, you have this concept of props. If I have a component inside my component, I can pass props to it. And as far as that component is concerned, those props become part of its own state. The other thing that we have is, we call it a store. And it kind of works the same way that you've seen stores work in other systems. A store represents a value. It's like an observable value, basically. And you can use that store without even using svelte. It's just an object that has a value, and you can subscribe to changes on that value. What svelte adds is it adds a tiny little bit of syntax, which makes the value of that store reactive inside your template. So if you have, let's say, a global volume value, and someone wants to slide that between 0 and 1 at the top level of your application, that's a store. Any component anywhere in your application can import that store and just use that value on an audio element, for example. And that's how we think about cross-component state management. And it seems to work pretty well.
Sounds like there's less to think about in a way.
This episode is sponsored by WordPress.com. WordPress.com gives you everything you need to create anything you want on the web. Whether you want to build a fan base, open a store, start a blog, design a portfolio, WordPress.com is where you can host that. You may be familiar with the self-hosted version of WordPress, the popular CMS that a lot of developers use, but what you may not realize is how easy, powerful, and inexpensive WordPress.com is to host your WordPress site. WordPress.com has plans for any budget. You can start for free and get your website running quickly. Then you can upgrade for advanced customization and themes, additional storage space, and business tools. You can build a blog, a full website, combination of both, write about your life, build a beautiful portfolio of your work, or build a robust business site. It's all up to you. WordPress has got a fast, intuitive editor that includes HTML and Markdown support, and they save your work every few seconds, so you'll never miss a word. And of course, WordPress.com has Jetpack essential features built in, including site statistics, basic SEO, and social media sharing. And if, like me, maybe you haven't tried WordPress's mobile app in a while on iOS or Android, it's worth checking out because you can update your site from anywhere on the app. Free plans get their choice of a few themes, and if you upgrade to a paid plan, you've got hundreds of themes that you can choose from for any kind of project. You can visit WordPress.com/themes and check out hundreds of premium themes that are vetted and supported by WordPress.com. Your site doesn't have to look like the traditional WordPress blog, text on the left, sidebar on the right. There's tons of options for different layouts and styles. Portfolio website, magazine, blog, business, a wedding, travel, food, maybe a wedding travel food blog, or just like a music blog. And in the past, you may have thought you couldn't install plugins, but using WordPress.com business plan, you can install any of the thousands of free plugins available. You can add a store with WooCommerce, try advanced SEO strategies with plugins like Yoast, or support multiple languages with Polylang. With unlimited WordPress plugins, you can build anything you can imagine and customize it to meet your specific needs. So visit WordPress.com today and build exactly the kind of site you need. Our thanks to WordPress for sponsoring this episode.
No, I'm impressed. I mean, this. I think Svelte comes up in conversations like, I don't know, Googlers, I guess I see, you know, they step into framework drama quite regularly. but they, you know, Svelte, you know, Preact or Svelte always seems to be kind of on the like list of, hey, maybe less JavaScript would work for you. I'm kind of blown away. I knew it was a framework. I knew it had kind of component-y structures. But I don't think I realized how cool it is that it kind of does a lot for you and then tries to disappear. It's sort of like, I'm picturing like when you do those introduction emails to people like in your company or whatever, you're like, all right, here you two meet, there you go, I'm going to step out. So I think that's really, really cool for a framework to do.
It tries to do as much of the grunt work as possible. And because it has this slightly different design and architecture, it's able to have a lot of features that you wouldn't conventionally include in a Vue framework because we're so paranoid about bundle size. We tend to have this preference for things that are minimal. And if you want to add new features, then you have to go and find a suitable library that interrupts with your framework. And it becomes this whole sort of teetering tower of dependencies. And that is something that I frankly, particularly working on newsroom deadlines, I don't have time for that. I just want something that contains all of the things that I need to do to build an application, but which also allows me to operate with whatever other tools exist.
Like you need D3 whatever cartography map you don't need, or like you can't wait around for like React D3 cartography map or whatever. You
just right
need the kind of lower level.
You need the low level stuff, but also, you know, you need to have styles, right? You need to have a way of thinking about changes in state between, like when an element comes into the DOM and it leaves the DOM. Maybe you don't want it to just appear. Maybe you need some kind of a transition. Maybe that needs to be controlled programmatically. All of the things that go into building like a really slick, pleasant to use user interface, a lot of them are kind of left as an exercise to the reader by some frameworks. And Svelte takes a different view. It takes the view that you should be able to do this stuff without having to learn a dozen different libraries. But at the same time, if you're not using them, you shouldn't pay for them. Particular features. If you're not using transitions, then you shouldn't pay for transitions.
Yeah, we just had Jason Miller from Preact on, you know, and they take a very hard kilobyte line, you know.
Yeah.
It's 3 kilobytes, hell or high water. And they're doing a great, I mean, I think that's amazing that they do that, but they, you know, but that does mean like, oh, a new feature like hooks, kind of dicey on how you're going to support it, you know, if you stick to your hardline. But they're doing it, but it took a big rewrite. So.
I like Jason, and I think we agree on a great many things, but on this issue, I think we're diametrically opposed. It sounded to me, because I listened to that episode, it sounded to me like what he was saying is that having that hard limit makes it easier to maintain the library. And that is that's a maintainer-centric way of looking at the problem when we should be looking at these things from a user-centric point of view.
Right. Well, is his user-centric not just less kilobytes equals good? But I think your user-centric point of view is...
My user-centric point of view is more features equals good, essentially.
More features.
As long as you don't end up with this crazy API with tentacles all over the place, then having a framework that does the things you need from your framework is the direction to go in. And I think the only other framework that really shares that philosophy is Ember, but Ember is obviously a very different beast to Svelte.
So has Svelte found a place with, has it clicked with a certain type of developer, a certain type of project, or a certain type of situation? Have you found that over the few years it's been alive, that it hits a certain person the right way?
I'll give you a couple of extreme examples. Last month, a developer in Brazil shared that it's being used for point of sale systems in Brazil. There's like 200,000 of these devices in the wild, and that his job was to build this interface for the point of sale system. And they're working with a very outdated version of WebKit on extremely memory constrained and performance constrained hardware. And they tried like a dozen different frameworks and none of them were up to the task. Like you would press a button on this interface and half a second later it would respond, which is kind of awful user experience because you're more likely to press that button twice and end up like overcharging your customers or something like that. And they tried it with Svelte and it worked smoothly. So that is an example of what you can do when you have a framework that has a very, very low memory footprint and very good performance. Another example, we have a guy using it in the context of smart televisions, which are also tend to be quite constrained devices.
Weirdly, but there, it's always the worst UI in the world. Like it's 8 FPS every time.
Right. So I think our community is, at the moment, it's people who really care about performance to the extent that they're prepared to eschew traditional frameworks. But, you know, once it gets a little bit more awareness, and I think that is starting to happen, like it was the number one write-in for the question, which front-end framework do you use in last year's State of JavaScript survey? So it is starting to pick up a little bit of steam. It'll be interesting to see if it does attract a particular community of developer. At the moment, it's as I say, it's people who obsessively focus on performance. And I think Svelte 3 is very largely about making a framework that appeals to developers beyond that, because it has this really nice developer experience. It's a much nicer developer experience than Svelte 2 was.
That's kind of a big deal. I think, you know, if we'd mentioned the maintainer experience and the user experience, there's, you know, I would think much bigger than either of the two, unfortunately, for better or worse or whatever, is the developers make decisions based on developer experience. And it's, you know, maybe that's not good all the time, but it's a little hard to blame them, you know, when productivity's on the line and whatever else, deadlines and stuff.
Yeah, I still prefer Svelte 2 developer experience to certain other frameworks, but, you know, people have preferences and it is pretty hard to shape those preferences. So I think the idea now is that there's really no excuse in terms of, oh, I don't know how I would use this in the context of my application. Like, it's really simple. It's really straightforward to use. And so hopefully we're going to be able to appeal to a slightly broader base.
Cool. I guess we should probably kind of look at wrapping up, but I kind of had like two more questions. Like, is there a situation where I shouldn't use Svelte? I mean, is there like, I don't, you know, I think frameworks are opinionated and make decisions, but, you know, is there sort of something like if somebody had a weird constraint, you'd be like, ah, oh, probably don't use this?
I can't really think of a kind of application that it's not suited to. I think the reasons that you would choose not to use Svelte are more social. You know, it's you've already got a lot of experience in a different framework and it's working well for you. You know, you shouldn't embark on a big rewrite just because something new has come along. You should only do that if you need to, because, you know, you're hitting a performance barrier of some kind. Or if you're working on a large team with other developers who, and you don't want to make them learn a new framework, then you probably shouldn't use Svelte.
That all plays a part. I mean, I'm on a project right now and we're like, what, you know, maybe I think we need it. It's time for a JS framework is sort of our discussion. And then one guy's like, I know Angular. And we're like, okay, yeah, that Angular might work in this context. And he's like, I'm writing it in Angular. And you're like, oh, we should talk about it. He's like, nope, I'm committing code in Angular. So it's like, oh, I guess we're on Angular. So, but yeah, it's stuff like that. You're like,
yeah,
I think that social reason plays a part in any sort of framework.
Definitely.
But then I guess, so how can people kind of hello world this or what's just follow the docs or?
We have a playground on the website, svelte.technology. If you click on the REPL link in the navigation, then you can start trying it out. And that has a download button. You press download and it will give you a prepackaged application ready to go with the bundler integration set up, all of that stuff. And it's pretty easy to take it away from there. We actually have a blog post as well on the easiest way to get started with Svelte. We've tried to make that onboarding experience as easy as it can be, given that it's such an unconventional approach, you know, in terms of not having a thing that you NPM install and import into your application. So we've tried to make that on-ramp as gentle as possible. I would say hop onto the website and give it a go, although maybe wait until we've got version 3 out the door.
Cool. Well, we'll look forward to it. Follow it on Twitter. And I notice y'all are super close to 10,000 stars. So Shopomaniacs,
what?
Go out and give the boost.
Dang.
So almost there, Shopomaniacs. Go click that star button. Put it over the top. Well, cool. Chris, did you have anything else you'd like to say? Or
no,
like,
just thanks for this discussion. This was awesome. It was different than I thought. I have never, I mean, I'm apologize. That makes me a crappy podcast, but I haven't even spun up a Hello World Svelte thing yet, but now I'm much more compelled. It seems fascinating, and I'm just in the mood to play with new things lately. So this will definitely be on my very soon thing to build something with.
Well, if you want to try out the new version, then just put v3 in front of the URL, v3.svelte.technology, and that'll become the main website once we've launched.
Yeah, I only use new things, so that's great. Ooh, even the design of it has been svelted.
Oh, whoa. This is sveltier for sure. Well, this is great. Man, secret URLs on the Shop Talk Show. This is wonderful. No, this is cool. I think I'm understanding how much like the tool can, you know, affect the output, if that makes sense. And that's very cool to see here. So I guess, Rich, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate all all your contributions to the New York Times. They're always like pretty amazing visualizations, and you did a privacy kind of a look into internet privacy recently. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, turns out that everyone knows where you are all the time.
Oh, bless.
That's one less thing to worry about, you know.
Hey, if you ever need to interview me, I ate a box of Cheez-Its and then YouTube was sending me Cheez-Its ads. So think about that. If you ever need, if the New York Times ever needs to kick off an investigation, just call me. So, but I guess for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
I have a job, so I don't need money. But if they want to follow me on Twitter, it's rich_Harris. If they want to follow Svelte, it's SvelteJS on Twitter. Or they can come to our website, svelte.technology. Oh, we also have a Discord chat room, which I always encourage people to come and hang out in. That's where the Svelte community chills out, and it's a pretty nice place. Everyone's welcome.
Cool. Awesome. Probably get some answers to questions pretty quick.
Yeah. So
that's great. All right. Well, thank you again. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast of choice. Be sure to star heart, favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.